Chapter 4. Nikki. In which a libertine who, in past adventures, nary blinked when inserting a telephonic implement in a woman's maidenhead, finds himself distraught by ordinary dating. At the bottom of the hill where the Pacific Coast Highway meets Canaan Doom Road, my eyes unclouded and I had a moment of clarity. I screeched to a halt in front of the World Gym, threw open the door, and unloaded the gun into the stop sign there. I was still pissed, but I wasn't stupid like OJ. I wasn't going to let Brandy destroy my life any more than she already had. I sat down by the side of the road and started crying. I couldn't take it anymore. She was destroying me, and she was destroying the children. This new piece of expensively bought information made it impossible to continue to tolerate her shopping sprees and meanness around the house. I had to get away from her. I wanted so badly for Brandy and I to be everything that my parents never were, but it was impossible when my relationship had crumbled from beneath me. When I confronted Brandy and asked for a divorce, our relationship turned from marriage to war, and she left the house threatening to take from me everything I owned and loved. I never realized how lonely the mansion could be. Not only was I now living by myself, fighting for my children in a custody battle, but I wasn't speaking to my mother, and I didn't know if my father was alive or dead. As for my band, the only real support system I had my whole life, they were a mess. Every day in the studio trying to make Generation Swine felt like an episode of Dynasty, with everybody plotting behind each other's backs. After I showed an engineer friend a song I had written at the height of my depression called Song to Slit Your Wrists By, he insisted I get out of the house. He started begging me to go out with a friend of his from Pasadena. She's an awesome girl, he promised. I don't know, I told him. I'm not really into dating right now. I just want to try and get my kids back. Nikki, you need to go out with someone. Snap out of it. She's a nice girl. You'll like her. I caved in and called her. She seemed nice enough, so I invited her out for some food. It was so out of character with how I used to meet girls before I was married, when all I had to do was lean against the sheetrock of the starwood and look cool. The drive to her place in Pasadena took an hour and a half. I arrived, opened the door, and sure enough, the bitch was cockeyed. Just like Angie Saxon's old roommate. She looked like a drunk Gina Davis. As soon as I entered her shabby chic house, I wanted to turn and flee. This was not my style at all. But I had driven all the way there, and she looked so desperate and expectant. So I took her someplace suitably pathetic like Chili's. She kept pounding scotches while I sat there watching because there was no way I was going to drive all the way home drunk. The more she guzzled, the louder and more obnoxious she became. Normally, I would have been just as drunk and loud, but sober, I didn't know how to deal with it. I just cowered and sank deeper into my chair. I took her back to her place, and she pulled me inside and asked if I wanted to watch TV. I made an excuse, but she sat me down and flipped on Fox anyway. This is my favorite show, she said. It was Cops. I sat as far away from her on the couch as I could. During a commercial, she scooted onto the middle cushion. After a few more minutes of silence, she asked, Do you want anything? I'll have some water. When she returned from the kitchen, she sat even closer to me. I wanted to get out of there so badly that sweat started streaming down the sides of my face. She scooted closer. Finally, I spoke. I have to go. I have a long drive. You should stay and watch Cops, she insisted. This is a really good episode. No, I really should be going. I have a long drive. I stood up and she jumped in front of me, all tall and cockeyed. I tried to walk around her, but she interposed herself between me and the door and puckered up her lips. I pulled back, but she only grew more aggressive. I needed to get out of there. A cockeyed Gina Davis was attacking me. I was going to kill my friend. I ran to my truck and peeled off, forgetting to even say goodbye or, I had fun, thanks. A minute later, my cell phone rang. It was her. This was turning into a horror movie. Why'd you leave? She asked. Well, you can spend the night if you want. I will do anything you want. Anything. No, I really can't. I will be your slave, she said. I will do you oh so right. I'm sorry, maybe some other time. What's the matter? Well, you know, you're, cockeyed. That was pretty much the extent of my blind dating experience. I met a cockeyed Gina Davis, then I met a cockeyed Meg Ryan, but I slept with a cockeyed Meg Ryan. Tommy had married Pamela Anderson, so he was feeling pretty high and mighty. Dude, you gotta stop going out with those regular girls, he told me. You have to go out with somebody who understands you, who's busy like you are, who goes through the kind of shit you do. You need someone famous. Look through a magazine, find someone interesting. I went to the newsstand and grabbed Details and Premiere. Drew Barrymore seemed kind of fun. Cindy Crawford was good arm candy. And Jenny McCarthy looked like a wild girl who could make me laugh in bed. I drew up a form letter and had Kovac fax a copy to each of their managers, oblivious to the fact that Jenny McCarthy was actually dating her manager. Not only did I not get a single response, but those letters would come back to haunt me. While we were finishing the album in the studio, I saw a copy of Playboy sitting around with a photo of some Baywatch blonde in the back. I noticed that she was a pretty girl, but I didn't think anything else about it. The next day, Tommy said, Pam wants to introduce you to somebody. Oh no, who? Some cockeyed David Hasselhoff? No, a girl she works with on Baywatch, and she's hot, dude. I didn't really want to go out with some narcissistic actress bimbo, so I tried to back out of it. Besides, Pamela never really liked me anyway, and when I tried to get her to make friends with Brandy, it was like mixing oil and water. However, Scott Humphrey intervened, as usual, and said that if I didn't want to go on the date, he'd go. So I pulled seniority. Cursing myself for giving in to another stupid blind date, I drove to the Baywatch set. I was standing in the background watching them film a scene around the lifeguard tower when a woman walked on set with beautiful blonde hair and a flowered sarong. It was the woman I had seen in Playboy. That's her, dude, Tommy nudged me. No way. That girl would never go out with me. I pictured her being bored as I waffled through dinner about the work we were doing on Generation Swine. I was sure I'd get shot down, and I contemplated sneaking away to save myself the embarrassment. She was too wholesome and all-American for a dirty fucker like me. After the shoot, I walked down the long dirt road to the beach and met her halfway, where Pam introduced us. Her name was Donna, and she couldn't have been any less excited to meet me. She didn't even look at me. She just nodded and walked to her trailer. I guess the last thing she wanted to do was get involved with a tattooed, heroin-shooting womanizer with three kids who was clearly still on the rebound from a messy marriage. I went back to Pam's trailer and waited, wondering if it wasn't too late to make my escape. Donna was clearly thinking the same thing because she walked inside and said, "You know what? I can't go. I don't have anything to wear." All Donna had was a long, loose-fitting pajama top that she had worn to work. "Just wear that," I said. "That's fine." She gave me a dirty look, left the trailer, and came back 10 minutes later in the pajamas. "Fine," she said. "Fuck it. Let's go." The blind date was already a disaster. Tommy and Pam led the way to the Dragonfly in their Suburban. I followed in my Suburban, and Donna brought up the rear in her Pathfinder. It was a stereotypical L.A. date, conducted by motorcade. I kept making sudden turns and racing through yellow lights, hoping she'd get lost. By the time we reached the Dragonfly, I couldn't see her in the rearview mirror anymore. I was safe. But a minute after I got out of my car, she pulled up behind me. I was stuck. We hung out on the patio and started talking. Afterward, we went to a club where everyone was fucked up and dancing. But we stayed sober and talked in a corner about music and about our kids. I was actually enjoying myself. Around midnight, I drove her to her car. I was running out of things to say, so I told her about my house and the swimming pool I was building. "Oh, really? A pool?" she yawned, feigning interest. "Yeah, and it's going to be shaped like a pussy. I've always wanted a pussy-shaped swimming pool so I can just..." "Oh, never mind." She rolled her eyes, and I saw any chance that I might ever have with her fly out the window. I dropped her off at her car and was so embarrassed I didn't even try to kiss her. Back at my big, isolated house, however, I felt so lonely and empty that I called her. I wanted to spend some more time with her and see if she was really as cool as I thought. We made a date to go to a restaurant in Malibu called Bamboo the next night. That morning, I took my kids to the Malibu Fair, where I ran into Tommy and Pamela. Pamela was carrying their son, Brandon, and her face was red with anger. Tommy was drunk off his ass, trailing behind her, and she was clearly pissed. I told her I was going to see Donna again, and she gave me a patronizing pat on the head. I dropped the kids off at Brandy's, changed into my only set of presentable clothes, and picked Donna up. Over a messy noodle dinner at Bamboo, I started having these feelings that were either genuine love or just rebound obsession. I wasn't sure, especially after I had fallen for Brandy so quickly and so wrongly. I was too scared to look at Donna because it made me nervous just seeing how beautiful she was. When she went to the bathroom, guys came up to the table to congratulate me for being with someone so hot. 12 years ago, I wouldn't have thought anything of it, but marriage had drained away all my self-esteem. Unlike my cockeyed dates with Donna, I wanted to take her out to the beach and talk to her all night. We had so much in common. We were both from small towns, we both loved children, and she was regarded by the world as this Baywatch sex symbol, while I guess I was seen as the same in rock and roll. But in our hearts, we both knew that we were just nerds, total fucking high school losers who had put on a good act and gotten lucky. Finally, I said to Donna, "Listen, I live just around the corner. Do you want to go to my house? I have some wine, we can kick back, and I can show you some lovely etchings of the pussy-shaped pool I'm building." "Okay, if it's close," she said. "Sure, it'll just take a minute." It was 25 miles away, and I knew it. She followed me in her Pathfinder up the Pacific Coast Highway to Canaan Doom. As we wound our way into the hills, she signaled for me to pull over. "How far are we going?" she asked, exasperated. "We're almost there." I led her all the way through Westlake Village and North Ranch, hoping she wouldn't get fed up and just turn around. Finally, we pulled into my driveway. "What the fuck is this?" she asked when she saw my Richie Rich mansion. She came in, sat on the $10,000 couch Brandy made me buy, and started drinking wine. I was too speechless to drink. I couldn't believe this beautiful girl was sitting on my couch in this house that I only associated with marriage, children, and the worst studio experience of my life. It seemed so wrong, yet I was enjoying it so much. I wanted to kiss her, but I didn't even know where or how to begin because I hadn't done it in so long. I was such a loser, a Frank Farana Jr. Finally, like a true nerd, I asked, "Can I hug you?" She said I could, so I melted into her for 5 minutes. I buried my head in her blonde hair and just lost myself like some kind of old, lecherous, sentimental fool inhaling the aroma of an 18-year-old for the first time in half a century. She had polished off most of the wine, so I suggested that she stay the night. Too nervous that she'd think I had the wrong intention, I quickly said I'd sleep in my bedroom and she could have the guest room. I walked her to the spare room, and before I could leave, she pulled me down onto the bed. Sober, I was able to enjoy every second and every caress. As we rolled around together, I was going out of my mind with lust. I probably had all the subtlety of a dog humping a doorknob. It had been such a long time since I was last pressed against a beautiful woman I actually liked and respected. I wanted to fuck her so badly, but I was so turned on I knew it would only last a second. Then she'd hate me because I'd be the lamest fuck of her life. "I have to go to my room," I told her.
"No," she whispered. "Stay."
I was exhausted because I wasn't used to staying up so late, but I was so excited to be lying next to this panty-clad bombshell that it took me hours to fall asleep. When I awoke, the sun was rising, and she was gone. I rolled out of bed, put on my robe, and found her smoking a cigarette on a veranda overlooking the future site of my giant pussy pool. Her back was to me, and she was gazing out at the multi-million-dollar mansions of my neighbors. "What are you doing?" I asked as I stepped through the veranda door. She turned around, startled, and saw this ugly rock star in a robe coming out of a giant white marble-filled house lit up by the rising sun. It looked like a scene from Scarface.
"This is way too much for me to handle," she said. I'm out of here.
You can't leave. You can't leave, I begged. She grabbed the rest of her clothes and ran out to her car with me in my robe, offering her anything if she'd just stay. She peeled out of the driveway and I stood there alone, knowing exactly how the cockeyed Gina Davis must have felt when I left. I was a monster who wine had somehow made attractive to this girl for about 2 hours. I sat down on the bed and started writing. She's so afraid of love, is so afraid of hate. What's she running from now? The song was called Afraid, and it was about both of us. In less than 48 hours, I had gone from being repulsed by this girl to falling in love with her, to having my heart broken, to being repulsed with myself. I fell into a fitful sleep for a few hours, then left her a message. Breaking every rule of making a woman want you by not seeming too eager, I told her that I hadn't felt so alive in a long time and I begged her to call me. She did, and apologized for running off scared. She had been so drunk, she said, that she couldn't even remember whether we had fucked. I told her that we had fucked all night and that afterward she had said I was the best lay she'd ever had. After a few more dates, just when everything was starting to work out, Donna screeched into my driveway and came charging at me waving a fax I had written. Evidently, Jenny McCarthy's manager and boyfriend worked with Donna's manager. And when he heard about the new man in Donna's life, he produced the form letter that I had written to Jenny McCarthy asking for a date. All of a sudden, I went in Donna's estimation from being a lonely, lovable rock star to a misogynist star fucker. To make matters worse, that afternoon we were playing with my son Gunner when Brandy burst into the house saying that it was her week to have him. Gunner was having a good time and didn't want to leave, but Brandy insisted. Though Gunner began to scream and cry, she didn't seem to care at all. In front of Donna and Gunner, she started to yell and humiliate me. I stormed out of the room, loaded the 9mm gun in my room, and swore that this time I'd do it. I was going to shoot that cold-hearted bitch in the head. I could hear Gunner's screams reverberating through the house. All my logic circuitry shut down, and my mind went black with anger. I came tearing into the hallway, but Donna caught me. "Take it easy, Scarface," she said. After a few minutes of arguing, I handed her the gun and barreled past her into my son's room. But Brandy and Gunner were nowhere to be found. She had already left with him. I collapsed onto Gunner's bed and burst into tears. I was a total fuck-up. I had probably scared Donna away forever. A funny thing about girls, though, is that the more you do wrong, the more they like you. Between those stupid faxes and my uncontrollable temper tantrum, she could see that I was a lost little boy who was badly in need of help. So she began helping me. The next day, she came over to my house with a gift-wrapped present, a 15-disc CD-ROM called Family Tree Maker. I typed in my name, then my father's name. The CD drive word and my parents' names appeared on the screen. Below them was my birth name and that of my brother, Randy Farana. Wait, my brother Randy? I didn't have any brothers.